Today is Friday, October 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, fighting continues between Turkey and Syria as more fatalities are reported. We have the latest updates on the fighting from our Pentagon correspondent. Also ahead, the U.S. president continues his offensive against impeachment.
My phone call, as an example, with the president of Ukraine was perfect.
And Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed Ali wins the Nobel Peace Prize. Those stories and more are all coming up next on today's International Edition. Turkish forces pushed deeper into northeastern Syria Friday, the third day of Ankara's cross-border offensive against Syrian Kurdish fighters that has set off another mass displacement of civilians and met with widespread criticism from the international community. There were casualties reported on both sides, and Turkey reported its first military fatality. A car bomb in the Syrian city of Kamishli on Friday killed at least three civilians and wounded nine more, according to the International Security Forces of the Kurdish-led administration. A reporter for VOA's Kurdish service was there and recorded these sounds. Rescue workers were still searching for dead and wounded in the wreckage, and the security forces said in that statement. The statement added that Islamic State militants had increased their activities since the beginning of a Turkish offensive into northern Syria this week without directly blaming the jihadist group for the car bomb. U.S. President Donald Trump says the U.S. mission of defeating Islamic State in Syria has been accomplished and that he plans to keep Turkey in line through economic and not military power. Mr. Trump told reporters Thursday that there are no U.S. combat forces in Syria, and he does not think Americans would want to send thousands of troops to fight there. Video taken at Tal al-Bayyad by Reuters News shows American military vehicles with United States flags flying on them. Joining us on the phone from the Pentagon is VOA's Carla Babb. Carla, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So, Carla, what can you tell us about the latest action taking place in Syria and Turkey?
Well, we actually just had a briefing with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, and Mark Esper, who is the Secretary of Defense, and they explained to us that the U.S. has moved about 50 special operators. They've moved them out of that 30-kilometer area. It's, you know, Turkey calls it a safe zone. We call it a security mechanism. Those have been moved out. They are saying that they've seen the Turkish fighters striking mostly with airstrikes, but there has been some artillery strikes across the border striking Kurdish positions. The Kurds have been trying to repel that. The United States has been asking both of them to stop the fighting. Secretary Esper said that the United States has not abandoned the Kurds. They have pushed back to the Turks at all levels from the president on up, but the Turks are inexplicably going on with this operation. But the facts remain, the United States did help convince the Kurds to dismantle some of their forces. So the Syrian Democratic Forces, which include a lot of the Kurds, have dismantled some of their defenses, and then the Turks came in. So that is the part where the Kurds on the ground feel like they were betrayed. But the U.S. here at the Pentagon assures all reporters that the U.S. is still working with their Kurdish partners and their Syrian Democratic Force partners everywhere else in Syria, and no U.S. troops have been removed from Syria at this time.
Has there been any comment from the Pentagon about the Reuters video that was shown showing U.S. vehicles with flags in the area?
I have not actually been able to get clarification on that. I tried to get clarification from General Milley during the briefing, and the briefing ended very abruptly. They had a hard stop, and he did not answer my question. As I understand it, the United States has moved out of two positions from that area, Tal Abyad and one other area. And so the footage that you're seeing, it could be accurate. U.S. forces could have moved out of Tal Abyad, but maybe they were still in the vicinity. It could be old footage. I am still trying to get clarity on that. All I know for a fact is that the United States has moved out of two posts from that area, and they're not supposedly in this zone that Turkey is targeting at this time. But that doesn't mean that they're not nearby.
Carla Babb reports for VOA from the Pentagon. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Earlier, I spoke with Omar Lamrani, senior military strategist for Stratfor, and asked him about the concern many have about how the military operation may lead to a resurgence of Islamic State militant fighters.
It is definitely a concern, a valid concern. There are about half a dozen large camps where former IS fighters are being held, prisoners are being held. A lot of these are pretty hardcore, dangerous individuals. More than 1,000 are in these camps. And so the concern is that as the SDF finds itself facing the Turkish offensive, they might divert some of the fighters away from these camps to the front lines, creating an opening for these IS fighters to come out of the prison camps and be dangerous in two ways. First of all, they can join the insurgency that's continuing to rage, albeit at a diminished pace, obviously from a few years back, in Syria and Iraq, and intensify it further. And the other threat is that these guys, these individuals, some of them have bomb-making expertise, some of them have infiltration training, and a lot of them are foreign fighters. So the threat is also beyond just the intensification of the insurgency in Iraq and Afghanistan.
What ultimately needs to happen to bring about long-lasting stability and a ceasefire or peace to the region, given the polarization that's in place?
Shot possibility here, option, but not a very likely one, is to go to the how things were previously. So in that sense, you have a strong central government in Damascus that is able to control its borders, monitor the local population, and give assurances to Turkey that there is no autonomous force that might stage attacks across the border, and if they do, then the governments will crack, the central government in Syria will crack down on them. But that's points towards a necessary arrangement between the SDF and the YPG and the central governments in Syria, which is a very difficult task to accomplish, given that the Assad government is obviously not at all in good terms with the Americans and the Europeans and the Turks, as well as with the SDF, who they would have to essentially bring back under their writ and under their control. So that's a very difficult option going forward. But really, over the long term, that's the only way to go back to the previous status quo that existed before the civil war and remove the imperative for Turkey to keep launching these cross-border strikes against what they see as an autonomous force that has extensive links to the PKK, which is operating and conducting attacks within their borders.
Omar Lamrani is a senior military analyst with Stratfor. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
The European Union says it has agreed with the United Kingdom to intensify Brexit negotiations in an attempt to reach a divorce deal ahead of October 31st, when Britain is scheduled to leave the bloc. The EU announcement came after EU Council President Donald Tusk vowed that the 27 nations would make another push for a deal following a constructive meeting between British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and his Irish counterpart Leo Varadkar. A cargo plane carrying presidential staff crashed in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo on Thursday, killing all 8 passengers and crew, a presidential advisor told Reuters on Friday. The plane carrying President Felix Tshisekedi's driver, a logistics manager, and some soldiers was headed to the capital of Kinshasa and went off radar Thursday afternoon, an hour after departing, according to the Civil Aviation Authority. Iranian officials say 2 missiles struck an Iranian tanker in the Red Sea off the coast of Saudi Arabia Friday. Iran state news agency said that the Sabiti oil tanker was hit some 130 kilometers southwest of the Saudi port city of Jeddah. U.S. President Donald Trump is meeting with Chinese Vice President Liu He at the White House today amid anticipation of at least a partial trade deal between the United States and China. At least 3 people were stabbed at a shopping center in the northern English city of Manchester Friday, and police said counterterrorism detectives were leading the investigation. Former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine Marie Yovanovitch appeared in Capitol Hill Friday for a deposition in the Democrats' impeachment inquiry, accepting lawmakers' invitation to testify despite President Donald Trump's declaration that his administration would not cooperate with the probe. Yovanovitch was recalled from her post in May and is now a State Department fellow at Georgetown University. Mr. Trump said earlier this week that he would block all officials from testifying. It's unclear if Yovanovitch's appearances signal a shift in that strategy or if she is breaking with the White House policy. Mr. Trump maintains that his July 25th phone call with Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky, which prompted the impeachment inquiry, was innocuous.
My phone call, as an example, with the president of Ukraine was perfect.
As we move into the weekend, I'm joined in the studio by VOA national correspondent Jim Malone to have a look at where things stand now. Jim, welcome to the program.
Hey, Steve.
So we have this testimony going on Capitol here. We have all these things taking place. What's the latest?
Well, apparently the ambassador has been talking to lawmakers about the fact that she believes that it was the president who was pressuring the State Department to have her removed as ambassador earlier this year, based on a concerted effort of Trump associates sort of campaigning against her. So this is going to add perhaps some context and some details to the overall inquiry into impeachment that the House Democrats have underway right now. We know the central part of this, of course, is the president's phone call with the president of Ukraine. But more and more details are coming out now, including the involvement of the president's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, in trying to affect some results in Ukraine to have the government there investigate Joe Biden and his son.
Right. And yesterday, two of his clients, Rudy Giuliani's clients, were actually arrested as they were preparing to leave the United States, tied to that.
Yeah. Let's be a little careful here, though.
Okay.
That's not what those two gentlemen are accused of, is campaign finance violations. And that's not exactly tied to Giuliani at the moment.
Okay.
So that's somewhat separate. But they were associates of Giuliani and sort of key players in, I think, his efforts to try to get information from the Ukrainians about anti-corruption efforts and, possibly involving the Bidens. So there's a lot swirling here right now, but the main thing to keep in mind is that the impeachment inquiry is moving ahead, they're hearing testimony. They did send the letter, the administration, earlier this week saying we're not going to cooperate, but as we're seeing today, they are getting some testimony.
And this is all coming as the Democrats are moving into their presidential debate next week. We're having a field of 12.
Yeah, it's going to be, I think, the most crowded debate stage ever in a primary debate. A dozen candidates at the moment, a couple of newcomers to the stage who were not in recent debates, like Tulsi Gabbard, Hawaii Congresswoman, and Tom Steyer, an impeachment advocate and environmental activist. So they'll be on the stage. The focus, of course, will be on Joe Biden. It'll be on Elizabeth Warren, his key rival right now, who's basically caught up to him in the polls. Not only in nationwide, but in some of the early contest states. And of course, we're going to be looking at the return of Bernie Sanders, who suffered a heart attack recently.
With so much focus being put on the impeachment proceedings on Capitol Hill and the president, are the Democrats in the debate at risk of focusing too much on that versus trying to get their particular messages out on what they plan to do should they get the nomination?
It's something they're going to have to calculate. The impeachment focus has kind of sucked the energy out of the Democratic race to a degree. The attention's on Trump. And unless you're Biden, Warren, or Sanders, you're not getting much attention as one of the Democratic candidates. They're going to have to find a way to become part of the conversation, but they're also probably going to have to weigh in on the impeachment inquiry. And by the way, all the Democratic presidential contenders basically support the idea of impeachment at this time.
VOA's national correspondent is Jim Malone. Thank you so much for stopping by.
Sure.
You're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
It's been long thought that people who smoke five or less cigarettes a day have less lung damage than those who smoke a pack to a couple of packs a day. A new study led by researchers at New York's Columbia University suggests even light smokers can experience long-term lung damage. Study leader Dr. Elizabeth Olsner, MD, an assistant professor at Columbia, says many people assume that smoking a few cigarettes a day isn't so bad. But her research team found only a small difference in the loss of lung function between those who smoke 5 cigarettes a day to smokers who go through 2 packs a day. The study also provides evidence contrary to the assumption that it only takes a few years for lung function to return to normal levels after smokers quit. Compared to someone who never smoked, it can take at least 30 years for an ex-smoker to reach normal lung function levels. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The 2019 Nobel Peace Prize was awarded earlier today.
The Norwegian Nobel Committee has decided to award the Nobel Peace Prize for 2019 to Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed Ali for his efforts to achieve peace and international cooperation, and in particular for his decisive initiative to resolve the border conflict with neighboring Eritrea.
Ethiopia and Eritrea, longtime foes who fought a border war from 1998 to 2000, restored relations in July of 2018 after years of hostility. Now for more, I'm joined in the studio by VOA's Salem Solomon. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So I want to begin here. What was the situation like between Ethiopia and its neighbors before the prime minister came to power?
Well, before Abiy came to power, if we start with the longest and intractable war, we have to take a look at the conflict between Ethiopia and Eritrea that lasted for over 20 years before he came to power. The border had been frozen, separating families and harming the economies of both countries. Periodic skirmishes erupted along the border, which was highly militarized. In fact, the stalemate between the two countries spawned a proxy war with each side accusing the other of supporting rebel groups meant to destabilize the neighbor. And Abiy did something that none of his predecessors were willing to do.
What was that?
He conceded territory along the border. He accepted the ruling by the Border Commission, which had been made years earlier, and he had even asked the UN to remove sanctions it had placed against Eritrea. So he was extraordinary in the fact that he was willing to compromise, which he did at considerable political risk at home. Because many people, especially hardliners within the dominant coalition party, did not want to see Ethiopia budge one inch in this conflict.
So if we take a look at the prize, I mean, what are some of the changes that the prime minister instituted, say, let's go back way in time, let's say his first 100 days that led up to this award being given out today?
Well, he was able to free political prisoners and journalists. He closed down a notorious prison, Makalai Prison, where torture was rampant. It's now become a museum, actually, in the capital city, Addis Ababa. He signed a peace deal with Eritrea, as we mentioned earlier. And internally, he worked to elevate and empower women to hold half of the cabinet seats, including appointing women in major positions such as the president of the country and head of the Supreme Court of the country. So he also played a key role as a mediator seeking to help bring about peace in other countries in the region, including Sudan, South Sudan, and beyond.
So, I mean, that's leading us up today, but, you know, all eyes are always on the future. What challenges remain?
Well, there's a lot of challenges. Ethiopia is currently experiencing ethnic tension like never seen in its modern history. It is also grappling with displacement. In fact, the UN says more than 1.5 million people were displaced by violence in Ethiopia in 2018 alone. Nearly all of them are internally displaced, or commonly known as internally displaced people. Abiy has faced assassination attempts, and there are numerous efforts to destabilize the country or break away from it by various rights groups. Human rights groups like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch are ringing the alarm, and they're saying that his work is not done. Amnesty said today that his work is far from being done and that he should push to motivate, this prize should push to motivate him to tackle the outstanding human rights challenges that threaten to reverse the gains he has made so far. And Human Rights Watch also said that he should use an ongoing negotiation with the Eritrea to press for urgently needed rights reforms there.
Now, if we take a look at those statements, I mean, is this award enough to push him to continue moving forward?
We'll have to yet see. There are issues still pending that he's trying to address. But, you know, and we'll have to see in the coming years to see how he uses this platform, his platform, to make advances in his country and beyond.
Salim Solomon reports for VOA. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
A powerful storm approached Japan Friday, threatening to batter its capital with heavy rain and wind, disrupting major sporting events that were planned. Reuters' Michelle Hennessy has that story.
Tokyo is bracing for what could be the fiercest storm to lash Japan's capital in 60 years. Typhoon Hagibis is due to make landfall on Saturday, but it's already disrupted the Rugby World Cup and a Formula One Grand Prix. Now it's raising fears of transportation chaos.
Typhoon Hagibis may cause record-breaking rainfall. It may be as powerful as Typhoon Ida in 1958. That caused a lot of rainfall and flooding in wider areas across Tokyo.
That storm left more than 1,000 people dead. This time, officials are taking no chances. Domestic airlines started cancelling flights Friday afternoon, and rail services are scaling down the bullet trains, with some lines to shut down altogether. Forecasters warn of potential storm surges along the Pacific coast, as well as floods and landslides. The approaching storm has forced the cancellation of two matches of the Rugby World Cup, and Japanese Formula One Grand Prix organisers cancelled all practice and qualifying sessions scheduled for Saturday. Japan is still picking up the pieces from a massive storm last month, which destroyed or damaged 30,000 homes.
That was Reuters reporter Michelle Hennessy. The suspect in a botched attack on a German synagogue that ended with two people outside of the building being killed has admitted to the shooting in a hearing before a judge. The German man, identified by the prosecutors as Stefan B., was ordered to be held in custody pending formal charges at a closed-door hearing before the judge Thursday evening. NASA Chief Jim Bridenstine says that SpaceX's new Crew Dragon astronaut capsule will be ready for the first manned flight into orbit in the first quarter of next year, provided that everything goes according to plan in the upcoming tests. Reuters reporter Ryan Brooks has those details.
Two, one.
SpaceX may soon be putting astronauts in orbit. On Thursday, the chief of NASA said the first SpaceX crew could fly early next year. NASA's Jim Bridenstine spoke alongside Elon Musk at SpaceX HQ.
Elon and I are in strong agreement on this, that the one thing we have under development that is of the highest priority is launching American astronauts on American rockets from American soil.
The two men have recently traded blows in the press and on Twitter, pointing to strain between NASA and SpaceX. However, Musk declared solidarity on Thursday.
This human spaceflight is the reason that SpaceX was created, and we're incredibly honored to partner with NASA and to make this happen.
Since the space shuttle program ended in 2011, NASA has had to rely on Russia's Soyuz rockets to put crew on the space station. That costs about $80 million a ticket. SpaceX and rival Boeing are both trying to develop cheaper alternatives. On Thursday, NASA's boss emphasized concern for astronaut safety and warned a 2020 timeline for a SpaceX crew could slip.
And that was Reuters reporter Ryan Brooks. Israel has asked Russia to show leniency to an Israeli tourist arrested on drug charges and has rejected an apparent swap involving detained Russian subject to an extradition hearing to the United States. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office says in a statement on Friday that he has spoken about the matter to the Russian president and asked for a commuting of the sentence. And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, producer and engineer Nick Ivanov, and managing editor K. Pound Dawson, thank you very much for listening to us today. You'll be able to find in-depth coverage of world events and news at the VOA News website. And don't forget, with our mobile application, you can download our stories and take them with you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great weekend.